We're still in the fourth essay of the Kuzari, and if you recall, towards the end of the fourth essay, Rav Yehuda Halevi now turns to really what is it, really Kabbalistic ideas. And when the Kuzar, when the king wants to know some of the wisdom of Judaism, the hidden wisdom of Judaism, so the rabbi wants to introduce some ideas from the Sefer Yetzirah, the Book of Creation. Just to remind people, Sefer Yetzirah is a Kabbalistic work that, again, the question is who's the author? Some attribute it to Avram, Abraham, some attribute it to Adam HaRishon, some attribute it to Rabbi Akiva, etc. The Kuzari actually takes the position that it was written by Avram Avinu. And the Sefer Yetzirah describes the process by which God created the worlds. And the theory of the Sefer Yetzirah is that the world was created by the combination of the spiritual essences which exist within the letters of the alphabet. Meaning to say, each letter is reflective of a spiritual essence. In fact, that's why Hebrew is called Lashon HaKodesh. Remember, I think I mentioned the idea that Mark Twain's joke, that Adam called a lion because it looked like a lion, right? Which doesn't make sense from a language standpoint, because until you call it a lion, there's no word lion. But in Hebrew, that's exactly the process. Because Adam HaRishon was gifted with a spiritual x-ray vision. He can look into a lion, and he could see the various components that comprised its spiritual essence. Knowing the spiritual essence of each letter of the Aleph base, one then works backwards and figures out, well, if you combine the Aleph and the Resh and the Yud, you get the spiritual makeup of the lion. That is the chemical reaction, as it were, that produces the lion. So this is the idea, which is referred to as Seifei Otiyot, the combination of the letters of the Aleph base can generate spiritual realities. And therefore the Sefer Yetzirah is filled with very, very complicated word combinations and Aleph base combinations, each of which has a deep spiritual significance because of the particular spiritual nature of each letter. This is the idea that God created the world, it is said, with 32 pathways of wisdom, and 32 is the same gematria as Lev, the heart. There are 32 pathways of wisdom, and these pathways of wisdom, 32, are comprised of the 10 sefirot, which I'll explain shortly, and the 22 letters of the alphabet. Right, so God creates via the number 10 and via the number 22, and 10 plus 22 equals 32, which is the lathe, the heart, the seat of understanding.
I'm trying to see the connection. I mean, there is a connection between the matria and the essences of the letters, but...
Yes. We don't know. Those are technically two distinct things, meaning to say, part of the spiritual force of a letter lies in its numerical connotation, but part of it lies in other aspects of which we don't know, its shape, its picture, its form. Because Hebrew is also, Hebrew is related historically and etymologically to other hieroglyphic languages. If you've seen, for example, older Hebrew, which is not the alphabet, actually, but it's, in fact, older Hebrew is a little bit of a misnomer because, at least according to rabbinic tradition, the Hebrew alphabet that we have was always the holy alphabet. That which is called Ketav Ivri, Hebrew script, may have been employed in common use, but it was never sanctified, meaning the consensus of rabbinic understanding is that you didn't start off with old Hebrew and then go to our modern Hebrew script. Rather, our modern Hebrew script, so to speak, was always the sanctified script of the Torah. But in popular communication, people use the other one. But be it as it may, Hebrew does have pictorial contents as well. So for example, just to give you two quick examples, there's a beautiful passage in Tractate Shabbat which talks about the way children were taught the alphabet. And they were taught the alphabet, and it wasn't just nursery rhymes, they were taught the alphabet by showing the various pictorial symbols that each letter stands for. So for example, it makes a point that if you take the word for sheker, lies, sheker. So you have a shin, a kuf, and a resh. Now the way a shin is drawn in a Sefer Torah, it doesn't have a flat base. The three heads of the shin stand on a point. The kuf also stands on one leg, and the resh stands on one leg. So the Talmud says that teaches us that lying and deception never has a firm foundation in the world. It's always standing on one leg and will eventually be toppled and discredited, and one does not gain from lying in the long term of things. On the other hand, if you take the words for emets, the truth, each of those letters has two legs. The aleph has two legs. The met, well, the mem has a very flat, solid base, and the tuf has two legs. That tells us that truth will always endure. Truth, even if in the short term there's difficulties and inconveniences, truth will prosper. So there are those types of things as well. It mentions the idea of Gimel Dalet. Gimel Dalet can be an abbreviation. Gimel Dalim, take care of the poor. Right. So you have so many possibilities here. You have Gematria. You have the pictorial image of the letter. You have possible abbreviations. Oh, yeah. Okay. No, I hope he's okay. Okay.
I didn't know he was
sick. No, that's okay. Okay. Yeah, you have pictorial images of letters and the like. So there are multiple layers of meaning in all of this. In fact, let me share with you another thought, which is really a later thought, from the Maharal of Prague. And again, it's not in Sefer Yetzirah, but it shows the significance of letters, meaning Torah, the meaning of Torah exists not only on the level of the word. See, in English communication, the primary vehicle of meaning is you don't really have meaning at the level below words. Even a word is only a partial thing, you need a sentence. In Lashon HaKodesh, meaning is conveyed at a sub-verbal level by a letter itself. In fact, the whole Bible codes idea is predicated on the fact, again, science is not such great science actually, but the theory is 100% accurate. In other words, the fact that, I think a believer in Torah believes that God may indeed have encoded all sorts of things, even though we're not able to find them. But the theory is that the Torah has a level of meaning beyond the words that are stated. Okay. And that's very, very interesting. This is actually given, if I mentioned this last week, forgive me, I don't remember what I had so many classes, I don't remember where I said what, but I think I may have mentioned that the Ramban, Nachmanides, writes that if a Sefer Torah misses one letter, the entire Torah is invalid, even though the omission of that one letter does not change the meaning of the sentence. Let's take Aharon. Sometimes you spell it with a vav, sometimes you spell it without a vav. If there's no vav, it's still read Aharon. So if it says, God spoke to Moshe and Aharon, so what difference does it make if my Torah has the vav or my Torah doesn't have the vav? The sentence is the same. The message is the same. The thought is identical. So Nachmanides writes that in the hundreds of thousands of letters of the Torah is contained the essence of God. God's name, we talk about God as a four-letter name, God as a five-letter name, God has a 305,000-letter name. That name is the Torah. The Torah is expressive of a concretized essence of God, to the extent that that's possible. If you're missing a letter, you don't have it. The Torah is no longer expressive of God's full divinity. And therefore the Ramban writes, even when the meaning of a pasuk on its verbal level is not changed, certainly things are changed on a transcendent spiritual level. In fact, in this sense, the Vilna Gaon offers a well-known interpretation of a Gemara. The Gemara discusses an interesting question. Who wrote the last eight verses of the Torah? What's so problematic about the last eight verses?
Moshe died.
The last eight verses said, and Moses died. Now, did Moses write the words and Moshe died? So here you have a problem. So according to one opinion, Moshe did not write those last eight verses. Moshe stopped writing right before that point. He then died. And the last eight verses were completed by Joshua. Now, according to one opinion, the last eight verses of the Torah were not even written by Moshe. Of course, either way, it's through God's dictation. That's not the issue, but who actually wrote it? It was not Moshe. It was Yehoshua. That's one opinion. But there's another opinion that says, no, Moshe himself wrote those last eight verses. The question is, did Moshe write a lie? So the Gemara says, Moshe wrote them, and the word that is used is bedema. So most people translate dema as damat, which is tears. Moshe cried. In other words, he wrote about his death and he cried. But the Vilna Gaon says, it's a little unusual. Why bring in that he cried? I mean, if you say that he wrote it, he wrote it. What's the issue of crying? So the Vilna Gaon, and here you have to know the Hebrew, Mishnah Yekibra a little bit. The Vilna Gaon says that the word dema does not mean tears. The word dema means a jumble or a mixture. What does that mean? It means the following. The Torah pre-existed the creation of the worlds. The Torah was before Adam. What form did this primary, in fact, it's described as the Torah was black fire on white fire. But what did the Torah say before there was a world? Did the Torah say, don't eat meat and milk? Did the Torah say, don't kill? Did the Torah say, keep Shabbat? That didn't make sense. There was no world, there were no people. What is the idea of the Torah pre-existing the world? So the Vilna Gaon says, the primeval Torah was the unbroken sequence of letters that spells out and represents the totality of divinity. The division of the Torah into words and sentences is only appropriate once there is a world. But the Torah that predated the physicality of the world still existed as a metaphysical, spiritual entity of an unbroken sequence of letters. The Vilna Gaon says, this is what Moshe Rabbeinu communicated. He could not write the words, and Moshe died, because he was still alive. On the other hand, the holiness of the Torah does require that Moshe be the one who acts as God's emissary in writing those psukim. So how do you get around the dilemma? He can't write a lie, but we require that he finishes the Torah. The Vilna Gaon says the solution to the dilemma is that the last eight verses were written as an unbroken sequence of letters, as it predated the creation. And only after his death did those letters take the form of words. So in this way, we resolve, the Vilna Gaon says, our dilemma. Every letter in the Torah was inscribed by Moshe Rabbeinu. But at the same time, he said no lie. Vayamat Moshe was not Vayamat Moshe and Moshe died. It was Vav, Yud, Mem, Tav, Mem, Shin, Hey. Unbroken sequences of letters. And that's what the Vilna Gaon says is the meaning of the phrase Dema. Dema, totally different explanation. Dema does not mean tears. Dema means jumbled letters, not broken up into words. But the reason I'm bringing this out is because you might say, what is the sense of this? I mean, if the sense of the Torah lies in the information it is imparting to us, what is the spiritual significance of sequences of letters? The answer, once again, is the holiness of the Torah, which is a repository of divinity, goes beyond a particular layer. In fact, there's actually a very, very radical idea in some Kabbalah, although I'll tell you ahead of time that this is not accepted as mainstream, in which it is asserted that although the Torah is eternal, God's Torah is eternal, but the particular configuration of words and sentences is a function of the particular stage in the evolution of history that we occupy. In other words, we believe that our history is 6,000 years. The concept is, because this is based on Psalms, that 1,000 years in God's eyes, 1,000 years in God's eyes is only one day. So just as God made the world in 6 days, and after 6 days there was a Shabbat, so too there are going to be 6 millennia. And after the 6 millennia are over, there will be Yom Shekulo Shabbat, that will be the eternal Mashiach and redemption, in which every day is a Shabbat in terms of our connection to God. And in fact, the Vilna Gaon has a very extensive, and well, he alludes to it, he doesn't really flesh it out, but he actually says that the historical events of each millennia are supposed to correspond with what God made on that particular day. Meaning the events of the first millennia correspond to Sunday. The events of the second millennium correspond to Monday. And you should be able to draw a parallel between, as it were, Briyata Olam and the unfolding of world history on these millennia. Okay, that's what the Vilna Gaon said. Now, according to that, of course, since we are in the latter third of the sixth millennium, and people sometimes get mixed up because they say, what do you mean sixth millennium? We're 5,000. But you understand, of course, when you're past the year 5,000, you are in the sixth millennium, right? So we are now 5,760, only 40 more years, so till the seventh millennium. So we are really Erev Shabbat, towards the late afternoon. Right? Erev Shabbat, late afternoon, it's almost Shabbat. Right? So at this time, on Friday afternoon, people will be running around, getting ready for Shabbat. Right? So that's the idea.
240 years.
I'm sorry, not 40 years. 240, yeah, but it's still true. Right? It's 240. So in other words, 760 years. Yeah, 760 years of the millennium have already passed. Right, so it is more than two-thirds of the millennium, so we are Erev Shabbat towards the late afternoon. But based on this idea, there's an idea that some of Kubbalim have suggested, that the Torah as we have it is for the 6,000 years culminated by its Shabbat. But under this idea, after the Shabbat, which will last 1,000 years, the world will be recreated at a higher spiritual level for another 6 days, culminating in 1,000 years of a higher and higher redemption. And that process will repeat itself 7 times. Because remember, after you have 7 cycles of 7, you have the Jubilee year. So the concept according to this is, there's going to be progressive recreations of the world at higher and higher and higher spiritual levels till the ultimate redemption of Jubilee, which would be the 50, in other words, after 49,000 years. So according to the idea that some of Kubbalim have said, a Torah that talks about not killing, not stealing, and the like is appropriate for the world that we live in. But at the higher level, there'll be a different type of Torah, meaning the same letters.
Right.
Same letters, but they'll form different words. Now, this is, I hesitate to mention this idea because on one hand, this is an idea that is some of Kubbalim articulate. This is also an idea that many consider to be absolute heresy and apikorsis, that one is not allowed to believe in, because they say it's a clear violation of the principle that the Torah is eternal. Their response is, well, the Torah is eternal, but it can take different forms. Well, once again, the question is, that's opening a very, very dangerous pathway. But the point that it does show is, though, it does exemplify in a very strong way that the holiness of the Torah is not a function only of particular word combinations, but there's a transcendent power in the letters themselves. And this is really the thesis of the Sefer Yetzirah, that it is the spiritual power in the letter that gives rise to the realities.
These people who say this logic of in Kabbalah that the Torah eternally is true, though the specific arrangement of the words and its meaning is temporary. Might they have said it because of certain things in the Torah that assumed to not be a world of perfection, like the existence of slavery,
mm-hmm.
and the existence of, animal slaughter and worship?
Mm-hmm. Well, it might be. And again, part of it is that, you know, we have to deal with a lot of contradictions in this, because on one level, we're told that the Torah is eternal and the Torah will apply even when Mashiach comes, etc. The Torah will not be abrogated. On the other hand, we do have various references to the fact that animals will not be killed. Right? That famous verse, the lion will lie down with the lamb, And that seems to say people will not kill animals, and animals will not eat other animals, etc. Does that contradict the notion of shechita, right? So there is some indication that changes might exist. So you're correct, that might be a basis for that.
And
of course, in a more spiritual world, we really need laws against murdering, and, you know, what's the point? Is that what people are going to be doing when the world gets reborn? So there is a concept here that there is constant progression upward. In fact, based on that, you know, we don't even know. I mean, I believe they even say, we don't even know if we're the first stage. Because there is a midrash that says God had created other worlds before this one that were destroyed. But that's one of the simple answers to Age of the Earth, etc., Ice Age, etc., these cataclysms. So the question becomes, well, was there Torah's eternal, right? But was there the Torah in some other form? Did it say, for example, don't commit cannibalism, right? Don't, you know, in other words, we're already existing at a higher level than something before us, right? We might be right in the middle. Although the Chayra, I mean, if the Vilna Gaon is, if they're making the calculation of the seven Shemitah cycles, the seven cycles, that seems to say that we're counting as one. Otherwise, you wouldn't be able to say there are seven cycles of seven. Maybe we're the sixth cycle or the seventh cycle, right? So they seem to be assuming that in the universe of Torah, we are the first, we are that first cycle. Yeah.
It would work out according to the principles you laid before regarding the relationship between our time and the 6 days of creation. It will come out that in Erev Shabbos it says that in Ben Hashmashos God created things that were not of this world and not of the world above. They were in between, and they were able to make exceptions to the laws of nature.
Right.
That would coincide with what they say about the end of days, that
things will be that there will be various miracles that will occur that will go beyond the natural order. By the way, there's another thing too. The Zohar, there's a famous passage in the Zohar. Again, it's not directly connected to this, but it's connected to the idea that we're talking about, where the Zohar makes the point that in the 600th year of the 6th millennium, so that would start around the year 5600, that's 160 years ago, there will be a tremendous opening of wisdom in the world. And this is based on an allegorical interpretation of a pasuk in Parshat Noach. If you remember the flood, it says the flood, the rain, began in the 600th year of Noach. And Noach was 600, or 599 in his 600th year. Now rain is considered to be a symbol for divine inspiration and wisdom. So the Zohar says that there's a remez here, an allusion here. The Zohar said, the Zohar was written a very long time ago, but it says in the 600th year of the 6th millennium, the double six, the gates of heaven will be open and there'll be tremendous wisdom that will descend upon the world. So if you work backwards, right, the 600th year of the 6th millennium is the year 5600. So now we're what? Now we're 5760, 160 years ago. So where does that take us? So 1900 and 1840, is that correct? 1840. Well, the start of the Industrial Revolution and the technological progress that began at that time. And then, of course, science accelerates to the degree that it's been estimated, although it's very hard to believe, that knowledge doubles. Scientific knowledge, it is said, although there's not a single person that has all this knowledge, but in the world, scientific knowledge doubles, I believe, every decade is the present way that it works. And certainly there's no question that the technological progress, which is an aspect of wisdom, it's not the totality of wisdom, certainly, in fact, but at least that particular aspect of wisdom grows at an exponentially great pace, starting really from around 1840. The progress that was made in the 19th and 20th century is many, many times greater than any technological progress in the thousands of years before then. And you could even trace it in other areas too. You could even trace it, some trace it even in Jewish learning. The Volozhiny Yeshiva, the great yeshivas there is in the yeshiva world, I don't know if my colleagues here are familiar with this, but in the yeshiva world, which you might call the golden age of analytical Talmudical analysis. Rabbi Akiva Eiger, the Vilna Gaon, Sam Sofer, the Ketzos, the Mesivas, the Shagas Aryeh, and then in the 20th century, Rav Chaim, and Rav Baruch Ber, Rav Elchanan, the great, great names of analytical learning had a tremendous flourishing from 1840 onwards, which was, I think, the Vashon Yeshiva was started around 1830 or so. And in Hasidus, at least, in spite of their disagreements with the Lithuanian yeshivot, do actually see this as kind of a mystical, and of course, and even in Hasidut, Lubavitch liked to claim that the Tanya was written then, etc., but they want to connect it to this idea. So as we approach Shabbat, so to speak, which means 5600 is also the latter third, right? It's the latter third of the sixth millennium, so as we approach the Shabbat, it's necessary for there to be an infusion of divine wisdom in the world to prepare the way for this Shabbat. Now, in a sense, though, what perplexes us is, well, if things are supposed to be getting so good, why are they getting so bad? Meaning, you're telling me that before Shabbat, there needs to be this infusion of holiness, sanctity, wisdom, technology, insight in Torah, a revelation of mystical ideas. All of this comes. But you have to heed the call. That's what I'm saying. Right, when Hashem calls. But anyway, but the thing, although there's actually a statement, there's a statement that says, of course you're not children, but it says that we don't take children out of learning Torah even if Mashiach comes. So if Mashiach comes, knocks at the door, we say we have to wait till class is over. You know, so that's the idea. Okay. BJE? Lenore Lehman? Is there a Lenore Lehman? Yeah, I'm sorry, I think you're calling the wrong office. This is the middle of a class. Call them in. Yeah, this is the right, that is this number, but that's not the correct one. Yeah, thank you.
Okay. It wasn't Mashiach.
Sorry. Actually, she didn't say.
Thank you.
Okay. Anyway, so one question is, well, if things are supposed to be getting better with all this kedusha, and on one level we've seen it, right? We've seen an infusion of learning, technology certainly, which is an aspect of wisdom. Yeah.
Well, also, I was just wondering, would 1825, the period of the Enlightenment, would that be considered it, or that's just
well, no. You're making a very good point. In other words, the concept is this: God made available in the world capacities for insight, but human beings then have the choice where and how to direct those insights. So, indeed, I would even consider the Enlightenment as a misdirection of genuine, you know, insights. I mean, there were certainly insights, there was certainly wisdom, but that can be used to destructive and even immoral ends. And that might be part of what's going on, right? Just like you can use Einstein for nuclear weapons, right? The relativity can be used to burn an atomic bomb, which can destroy a world, or it can be used to understand the deep structure of the universe, right? That's a function of choice. In other words, which is part of our solution, God does not force wisdom and insight to be used in good ways. He makes those powers available. But part of it, too, is you have to understand, and again, this is a Kabbalistic idea, but it's based on a verse in Ecclesiastes, Zel yumatza asal lohakim, God makes good opposite evil. Meaning to say, as goodness gets stronger in the world and more visible, evil puts up a fight. Every action has a reaction. And that's because God wants there to always be a struggle in the world to facilitate choice and moral autonomy. So it's no accident that as things get better on some level, there's going to be this death struggle against it at the same time in terms of more immorality, more decadence, more evil. Right, I'm sure all of you have heard. I mean, now we have first graders killing first graders. I mean, just things that are beyond imagination. But you have to understand that on a cosmic level, this is the last-ditch attempt to destroy the good that undoubtedly is revealing itself more and more. And that's why we have the paradox that more and more Jews come back to Judaism, in a world which is more and more corrupt. And in fact, at some level, it is the corruption and the decadence that brings people back, because people realize the bankruptcy, the moral and spiritual bankruptcy of secularism and materialism and socialism, whatever other ism would otherwise dominate their lives. So, in a sense, evil is also a blessing, because it is sometimes the evil of seeing the decadent end of the alternatives that bring a person back to God. Because after all, you know, if a secular society would succeed in being moral and happy and good, what would be the push for me to go to God? Everything's fine without mitzvot and without those commitments, right? So that is why in Chazal there's a deep-seated idea, which is really based on prophetic writings, that before Mashiach there's going to be birth pains, Chavlei Mashiach. And Chavlei Mashiach, although it is described in the books of the prophets as wars in particular, but wars are also understood in a metaphorical sense. Not only, you know, armies fighting against each other, but it also refers to the decadence and the immorality and the lust and the sensuality and the absence of any type of commitment to things that will be trying to dominate the world. So, and, you know, so there is indeed a life and death struggle going on, but on the other hand, we view it this way. The strength of the evil indicates the tremendous strength of the good. Because God always creates this cosmic balance, meaning if the evil is fighting so hard, there got to be an awful lot of good that's lurking there. And therefore, this is the concept of Chavlei, of the Chavlei Mashiach, the birth pains of the Mashiach. And that's why, with all of this technology, which is symbolic of wisdom, there's also this great potential for evil and abuse. In fact, I heard actually a very nice talk from Rabbi Kaplan. We were speaking somewhere in Northern Virginia, and he actually mentioned that you could actually break down from 1840 to today, you can break down things, it's really taken from future, you know, Alvin Toffler, people like that, but you really have three stages in this industrial, technological age. You have the first stage, which might be the Industrial Revolution. That's mass production, machinery, getting things done. And then you progress, let's say, in the 20th century to what might be called the Atomic Age, starting with Einstein. And I'll discuss in a moment what is the significance of Einstein in particular. As you know, Einstein was man of the century. Even Time Magazine acknowledged, I guess it was either Einstein or Hitler, apparently. Those were the two... No, that was the debate. Yeah, Time Magazine was going to choose man of the century.
Exactly. This
and they were actually very much leaning to Adolf Hitler, not in a positive way, but in terms of the person that had the greatest impact on the century. And apparently word got out, and there was massive protests. So they went with Einstein, and then pretended that, you know, as if they had to defend why we didn't choose Hitler. I mean, they didn't choose Hitler because thousands of people wrote letters about it. But be it as it may, that's Einstein. And then we come to the a computer age, which is relatively modern, which is called the information age. So we have the Industrial Revolution, we have the Atomic Age, and we have the information age. And Rabbi Kaplan suggested that this represents three distinct unfoldings of spiritual power in the world. And that is the following. If you look at the first stage, the Industrial Revolution, the concept of mass production, etc., in order to facilitate mass production, things have to be combined together, meaning workers have to combine and do things together, products have to be combined in certain ways, whether they're chemical combinations or physical combinations and the like. Now, in every combination, there is the concept of sub-level, whether it's a social combination, or a chemical combination, or a physical combination. Each component is surrendering some of its individuality. I mean, very simple idea. If you're baking a cake, so the egg is the egg, and the sugar is the sugar, and the chocolate is the chocolate. But in order to be combined, the egg has to surrender some of its eggness into the mass. And the chocolate surrenders, so a chocolate may be a dominant ingredient, because it'll throw out its color, but it surrenders. In other words, successful combination, whether it be marriage, whether it be an employment organization, whether it be chemical combination, by definition involves a certain degree of obliteration of the self and surrender of autonomy in order to create something higher and better. That's the theory. So the first stage of this spiritual development is symbolized by our willingness to surrender some of our ego, to be open to God. That's level number one of spiritual unfolding. So the Industrial Revolution is a symbol of a parallel spiritual development that could take place within our hearts. Now, not that it did, but the concept is what manifests itself physically corresponds to a spiritual reality that could or should have taken place. Then we come to the atomic age, right? Einstein and really not just Einstein, but what you might call the age of physics. Remember, it's a very funny thing that in the 19th century, one of the great physicists said that everything that can be discovered by science has already been discovered. There is nothing left to discover. One of the great, you know, really untrue statements of all time. This was right before the atomic age and the like. Now, one of the amazing things about the atomic age that it's shown us is it has shown us the total unity of all things. Because when you break things down to their subatomic particles, those subatomic particles are identical, whether it's a table, whether it's a person, whether it's a lion or the like. Meaning you say that the fundamental building blocks of the entire universe are identical building blocks that are just put together in distinct and unique combinations. And therefore, this itself is great, great credence that that which is one emerges from that which is one. And therefore, the apparent multiplicity of things is really an illusion because the fundamental bedrock reality is unified. That's a lesson, one of the lessons of the atomic age, right? A proton or quark or whatever particles you have. And of course, we see other things in the atomic age too. I had mentioned the uncertainty principle in which subatomic particles do not behave in accordance with any predictable pattern. Even though in the aggregate we see predictability and stability, and that is the reconciliation of free will as individual versus God's plan in the aggregate universe. Right? The whole physical reality is very instructive regarding some, although we can't explain it rationally, but we know this is the physical reality. So our eyes see this, or our measurements see this, and therefore a lot of the classic philosophical conundrums of free will versus God's omnipotence can actually be understood in light of the atomic age, the uncertainty principles and the like. Now the third advance is the computer age or the information age. And here the great thing is accessibility of information, meaning knowledge has always been out there, but it was not accessible for many people. Now we have the notion of cheap accessibility. Of course, that has a cost, right? Because cheap accessibility also means accessibility to junk and inaccurate information and the like. But that is our world. Our world is a world of accessibility. The truths of spirituality are accessible to people in a way that may not have been the case before. That's why you find, for example, that even Kabbalah and the mystical parts of the Torah are now being revealed in various ways. But the cost of that is there may be also a lot of inauthentic falsity. So in effect, the three stages from 1840, Industrial Revolution, the Atomic Age, and the Information Age, do correspond to potential spiritual transformations within us. The Information Age, the need to obliterate the ego to become part of a greater whole. The atomic age, the essential unity of matter, and the indeterminacy of particles on an individual level, and the information age, the accessibility of spiritual truths. So all of this, again, lends credence to the idea that even as we go into Erev Shabbat, towards Shabbat, there are different stages in how God enables us to be prepared, right? Teaching us that we have to learn to surrender some of our arrogance and ego, which of course, by the way, is a difficult thing as one grows in this wisdom and understanding. The dangers are very much greater. There is the notion of recognizing the fundamental unity of creation despite its apparent multiplicity, and the notion that God makes these truths accessible to us in a relatively easier fashion than perhaps would have been the case before.
I suppose when we talk about the computer age, one thing that I've always found to be very interesting, the speed at which things can be accomplished with computers, mm-hmm. I think also further underscores the possibility of God. Of course, we know that God's creation of the world in such a short period of time.
Right.
People always have it possibly to see billions of years.
Yeah, acceleration of things.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's a good point.
Do something in billions of things
right.
in a split nanosecond.
Right.
Surely God can do it.
Right. Well, that's a good point. People say the same thing about video cameras. You know, it says, does God really see everything I'm doing? Well, the answer is plenty of other people can see everything you're doing. We have all sorts of ways of doing it. And basically, the advances of technology teach us about divine potentialities and the like.
I think the thing about computers, one thing is, in addition to what we said, accessibility, is that with this speed and doing multiple changes quickly, information that wasn't accessible to us as scientists, for example,
mm-hmm.
is becoming accessible. For
mm-hmm.
example, what's happening now is molecules are being cloned. That is, we know sequences of molecules that they have certain properties
mm-hmm.
that we want, but we would like them to be better. We want them
mm-hmm.
to want to generate something that would do a certain job.
Mm-hmm.
So what's being done is random combinations are being made of these molecules that do those jobs and they're being tested.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that kind of thing.
Yeah, you're dealing with really the creation of life,
essentially,
yes, and cloning these various other things. Yeah, and of course that really brings us back to Sefer Yetzirah, which had ways of creating life, and we seem to have ways of creating life. Obviously, it's very problematical. The whole issue of human cloning, which is only one extreme example, but there are many, many other possibilities just on the molecular or genetic level, which on one hand could have great, great potential boons for therapies and the like, but it also raises a lot of ethical problems. Certainly, and you know, one of the concerns people have expressed with the entire human genome project is that, you know, the old phrase, we're playing God. Now, we're playing God is an overgeneralization, which really is not, it doesn't really say that much, because, you know, people say, we shouldn't do this because we're playing God. Because one could actually argue that a human being is supposed to play God in some level, because if we're in the image of God, God has given us wisdom and creativity to be his partner in bringing goodness into the world, both moral and spiritual goodness, and even scientific and technological progress. Right? Jews are not quiescent, meaning we don't take the position if somebody is sick, like a Christian scientist would say, well, God wants them to be sick, so what gives us the right to intervene? We certainly don't say that. We don't say, well, if people get polio, you know, it's God's will, and therefore we shouldn't fight it. In other words, we believe it is part of our mission, as it were, to relieve human misery and suffering, as well as bring holiness into the world. So the notion that it's wrong to play God is not entirely accurate. Part of our job is to play God. Not to play God, but what I mean to say by that is to engage in things that in former years would have been left to God because of lack of knowledge, but we now have the knowledge. But on another level, it is true that when we engage in godly functions, we have to be aware that we are God's junior partner, not God's equal or senior partner. And then, of course, you get into those problems. So it's very, very scary. I mean, it's very scary when knowledge and technology outstrips moral sensibility and awareness. And that is really where things are very, very dangerous. It's like, you know, giving a gun to a child, basically. They have all of this power without a sense of moral restraint.
Technology is
also
a speed
remark to
God's meaning. Because
we're
using technology
as a
benefit to give us knowledge as a benefit. Right. Right.
Right.
Precisely.
Yes. Yes.
We know that it's still wide open from engineering and science.
Oh, sure.
So far behind. Still
that's right. It's amazing.
Compared
yeah.
to what
yeah.
can be moved at what speed and so on.
I remember, you know, and I'm a computer novice. I'm probably up to third grade level now. I've improved a little bit, but But the first computer I got, only 6 years ago, my modem was 2400. You know, not 2400. I don't even think you can get that in the antiques, you know, maybe computer antiques or whatever it is. But, you know, that also has a cost in a psychological way, and that is, we do live in a world where we need instant gratification. You know, I remember, if you remember the, not remember, but if you remember your American history, the War of 1812. So Andrew Jackson was one of the heroes, before he was president, was one of the heroes of the War of 1812, and he won a congressional medal for the Battle of New Orleans, one of the, it was a decisive battle against the British, but it was fought 3 weeks after a peace treaty was signed in Belgium, the Treaty of Ghent. The war was over. The war was over, but nobody heard about it in America. It took a long time to get it over to the Atlantic Ocean. So he won a medal, Congressional Medal of Honor, for a battle that he won after the war was already terminated. Right? That's how long it took. I mean, imagine if you had to send a letter from New York to Baltimore. It might take 4 days. It still may take 4 days, actually. That's funny. But okay, have he improved. But be it as it may, you know, things were very, very slow. Now, I remember I had to send a fax to China, to Hong Kong, the other day, and it took around a minute. And, you know, I'm drumming my fingers. A minute. What is taking so long? You know. So the concept is that we have been inundated with the ability to get things done so quickly that we want instant gratification. Now, that has some very drastic consequences in terms of a spiritual life. So, for example, if marriages don't work right away, you know, we turn to divorce, abortion, things that are quick fix solutions to problems instead of investing the time and the effort to work on them. Even spirituality, New Age spirituality, in many ways, is an attempt to reach some type of spiritual high with a minimum of effort and commitments. You want to get it right away. You want to feel close to God right away. You want to get that instant rush. Drugs are that way. A person is habituated to a certain euphoria, which you want to get by this sudden influx, without even feeling at the moment that there's going to be a tremendous, tremendous crash afterwards, and a destruction of everybody around you and yourself. So all of this is symptomatic of the concept of what's called an instant gratification society. And Judaism does not preach that, right? Judaism does not believe that, you know, you start keeping the Torah and you'll immediately, right away, be filled with tremendous joy and fulfillment. It's a gradual process. You're looking at the long road. You're looking at a journey, not at a sudden destination that you're going to reach. And you build it brick by brick and layer by layer, and you find fulfillment in the process as you're going along, which is really the antithesis of the instant gratification. Yeah, so there are good sides and bad sides. In other words, you're correct. The computer teaches us about God's power, because, you know, how fast God can do things, but it also, to some degree, spoils us, it and many other things, in terms of this instant gratification that you have to have. And that's very, very destructive to spiritual life. I mean, that's why, for example, kids, I don't want to generalize because there are obviously exceptions, but that's why, for example, when children get hooked on computer games or whatever, they will very often not want to read as much. And part of that is because reading is another example of something that, by and large, is not an instant gratification. You have to be invested with it, you have to concentrate, you have to think, etc., as opposed to the passivity of the TV or whatever, where you get images just right in front of you, not leaving anything to the imagination, etc. And so the instant gratification is a very, very serious problem that we face, and we face it even in our mitzvot. We want our mitzvot to give us immediate highs, when Hashem says, oh no, you got to work on the soul to be able to feel that. It doesn't happen all by itself.
So how are you calling it Kabbalah?
Well, yeah. I mean, you have Madonna, and you have, what's the other one? There's another Kabbalist in Hollywood.
Like a shortcut.
Yeah, right. Yeah, nirvana, instant gratification, which on one level we understand that, because all of us would like to have, all of us want that, all of us want a feeling of closeness.
But the instant is very long compared to the speed.
Well, yes, that's true. But let me give you another example, though, of this power of the letters. It's a beautiful quote of the Maharal. Now, again, just to remind people of the history here, the Maharal, we talk about Maharal on and off a little bit. I mean, he's not officially a part of our course because he's much later. The Maharal was in the 1500s. But the Maharal is at the tail end of what is often conventionally defined as the medieval period. The Maharal is a Renaissance figure. Right? The Maharal is the beginning of the Renaissance, or a little after the beginning of the Renaissance. He was in Prague. But still, the Maharal was well aware of Copernicus and various other scientists and the things that were going on at the time. So in terms of even Jewish philosophy, the Maharal is really at the tail end of the medieval tradition and the start of Renaissance and the like. And therefore, the Maharal doesn't really belong to the older philosophical tradition that includes Rav Sadia Gaon, going back to the 900s, Rav Yehuda Halevi, Maimonides, Sefer HaKarim, right? The Maharal is a little bit after that. But what the Maharal does do is the Maharal does attempt to combine and integrate many, many different strands of thought. So he does utilize medieval Jewish philosophy, particularly in terms of his vocabulary. His vocabulary is almost totally drawn from Platonic and Aristotelian, mainly Platonic terms that were used by Rambam and the like. But the Maharal also integrates the ideas of Kabbalah, which Rav Yehuda Halevi does a little bit, Maharal actually does it much more, although he never refers to Kabbalah. It's very interesting. Maharal never refers to mystical literature. I believe he mentions the Zohar only twice in a huge, huge corpus of writings. And he mentions no other book of Kabbalah at all. But it's very, very clear that the Maharal essentially is trying to expound Kabbalistic ideas using the familiar, for that generation, the familiar terminologies of medieval Jewish philosophy. So the Maharal is a great integrator of philosophy and mysticism in one unified vocabulary. So he's an interesting figure, and the Maharal in turn, it's well before the Hasidic movement, which is 200 years later, the Maharal in turn is considered to be one of the great spiritual fathers of Hasidut, which also tried to popularize and utilize mysticism for their purposes. But the Maharal talks about a famous passage in the Talmud, and perhaps those of you who are married, perhaps you heard this at your wedding or Sheva Bracha, because it's a very famous Gemara. The Gemara talks about the fact that the name for man, which is Ish, and the name for woman, which is Isha, have two common letters, an Aleph and a Shin. Now the man gets a Yud in his name as well, Ish, and the woman gets a Hey in her name, which is Hey. So Yud and Hey is God's name. It's the first two letters of the Tetragrammaton, the Yud and the Hey. So the Talmud says very beautifully, if a man and a woman bring God into their life, they will function as a man and a woman living together with joy. But if they banish God from the marriage, if they take out the Yud and the Hey, right, they take out the Yud and the Hey, what are they left with? Eish, fire. Their egotism, their selfishness, their desire for looking for after number one is going to consume each other in a sense of destruction. Right? It's a beautiful thought. This is a Talmud, this is not the Maharal. The Talmud says, therefore, only when there's God in their lives do they live as man and wife. Without God, there is only fire and destruction. But the Maharal takes the statement one step further. Why does the man get the letter of Yud? Right, God's name, Yud and Hey. Why does the man get the Yud and the woman get the Hey? Right, why does each one get that particular letter? So the Maharal explains the following way. And again, it's based on a passage in the Talmud and also in the Sefer Yetzirah, that Yud, the spiritual power of Yud, was the force through which God created the world to come, the spiritual world. And that's symbolized by the notion that the Yud has no spatial dimension. The Yud is actually a little point, it's a little dot. It is beyond space. It doesn't take up any area. It takes up some area, but it is supposed to be symbolized of absolute nothingness or emptiness. Therefore, it is a pure spiritual world that is not bounded by dimensions, and therefore Yud represents Olam Haba. Hey, the Maharal says, you have to visualize a hey in your mind. Hey symbolizes a composite of two letters. Mm-hmm. Hey is a Dalit, and the Maharal says it's a Dalit and a Yud. I would have thought a Dalit and a Vav, but he says it could be a Dalit and a Yud. If the leg is small, it could be a Yud. So he says the following. Dalit, which is four, represents total materiality and physicality. Because four, the four directions, matter occupies four directions of space, and matter occupies four dimensions of existence. You have height, width, length, and time, because that which is physical finds its existence in time. That's the fourth dimension. So four represents pure physicality. Yud, we just said, represents spirituality. Bringing the Yud into a Dalit is the capacity to bring holiness and spirituality into the mundane physical details of existence. So the Maharal actually suggests, and again, in this age where we don't like to assign roles, this is always a dangerous mechanism, I'll just share with you the thoughts, and that is to say that men, again, these are generalizations, they don't apply to every man or every woman. We're talking about tendencies, masculine tendencies which can exist in women, and feminine tendencies that can exist in men. I'll get to that. You know, you're right, there's a reason for that too. Men tend to be, as it were, corrupted. the workplace tends to generate feelings of egotism, jealousy, possessiveness, and therefore men achieve their maximum holiness when they can withdraw from some of this, like getting pure oxygen. They need pure oxygen, and therefore their connection to God is primarily achieved by the Yud, which is the world of pure spirit. The woman's capacity, as a generalization, is to bring the Yud down into the world of the Dalit, that in the confrontation with reality they can create a sanctity in human relationships. And again, I mean, this is a well-known phenomenon that, you know, I know as a law professor, we now have around 52% of the entering class of law schools is now comprised of women, more than 50%. And it's been well documented that women have had a significant change or impact in humanizing some, not that successful, it's true, but in humanizing the legal profession. So for example, the great emphasis in recent years in some circles on alternative dispute resolution, that instead of going to court and suing people for every cent that they're worth, the concept of trying to work things out in settlement, in discussion, in negotiation, and the like. Many have said it's no accident that the rise of an emphasis on alternative dispute resolution has corresponded to a rise of women entering the legal profession. Again, I don't want to get into politics too much, but the Maharal makes the point that there's a capacity in the confrontation with the real world, whether it be raising a family, whether it be humanizing a working environment, whatever it might be, that there's a holiness that can be brought into the mundane. That for a man, that is often a difficult trial, that is hard to manage. So, therefore, the concept is this. It is true that a hay is only half of a yud, right? Hay is five. But what does that mean? That means to say that a holiness that is disembodied from reality may often be a stronger, more intense peak experience of ecstasy. Meaning, to have to bring in holiness when you're dealing with, you know, mundane human relationships and taking kids to carpool and working with uncooperative people in a workplace, it's hard to feel, you know, you're on the high mountain getting all that spiritual energy. So it might only be a hay, as it were, but it ultimately is the purpose of the creation. The purpose of the creation is not to have holiness that is disembodied from reality, but to have a holiness within the confines of the physical reality that God has created. And that is why it is said, indeed, that Avraham's first name was Avram, and Sarah's name was Sarai, but after circumcision, the yud of Sarai was split into two hays. Meaning the lesson to Avram and Sarah is, don't keep your spirituality on the level of a yud, but rather take the yud and bring it into the dalit. Right? So again, all of these thoughts we're talking about today are simply designed to show us that within the letters of the Aleph Bet, this is just illustrative of a tiny fraction of different things, that within the letters of the Aleph Bet, there is kochos, there are powers and symbols and significance, which well go beyond words. Because as they say, in English or any other language, there is no significance to letters beyond the words that they form. In Lashon HaKodesh, the letters themselves, the holy tongue, the letters themselves have this quality of holiness. As I indicated, they are literally considered to be the spiritual DNA for every physical thing that exists. Now, based on the... I'm sorry.
Rabbi Abravanel lived about 100 years before the Maharal, and each of them wrote a Haggadah.
It's less than 100 years. In fact, their lives may even have overlapped, but if
the end
not,
in the beginning.
Yeah, if not, the Abravanel died very shortly before the
right.
Maharal. Yes, they both wrote Haggadahs. In fact, Abravanel and Maharal are very, very... Well, the Maharal, you might say...
Both of the Haggadahs.
Yeah.
But you say that what surprises me is when you said the Maharal used Aristotelian language.
Well, okay. The Maharal actually uses more Neoplatonic language. If you want to give it a formal designation, the Maharal, as a philosopher, was closer to Plato than Aristotle. That is true. But the reason the Maharal disapproved of the Abarbanel, he had great respect for him, was really for another reason, although it is related to the philosophical tradition, and that is the Maharal, as did many other Jewish philosophers, took the freedom to disagree with statements in the Talmud and the Midrash if he felt that he had an alternative philosophical reason that he thought was better. And the Maharal, in a sense, was very, very one of the strong points that he constantly advocated is that we have to regard the statements of the rabbis in the Talmud and the Midrash as binding on matters of faith and philosophy. Even though we can interpret them in philosophical terminology, we can never reject the truths of what they're saying. So the Maharal had a great, great disagreement with any biblical commentator who did not follow the lead of the Talmud and the Midrash. I'll give you another example. He was very harsh against the Ibn Ezra. The Ibn Ezra was much earlier. The Ibn Ezra was a contemporary of Yehuda Halevi in 1000. They were related even. The Ibn Ezra, I think, was Yehuda Halevi's cousin. And the Ibn Ezra also constantly interprets verses inconsistently with the Talmud. And the Maharal, says, can't do that. Not allowed to do that. We have to look at the Talmud and the Midrash as our source. That was really the disagreement. So the Maharal was not against philosophy per se, but he felt that as Yehuda Levi probably would do as well, that the Talmud and the Midrash have to be put on the first tier. Yeah. Okay. By the way, the Abarbanel, again, it's a figure we haven't been studying too much, but the Abarbanel was very interesting because he was almost the only Jewish philosopher who was interested in issues of politics. Now, if you go back to Aristotle, was kind of like the secular Bible for all medieval philosophers, Jewish, Arab, Christian, Islamic. Aristotle was essentially the Bible. And Aristotle wrote on a tremendous number of subjects. He wrote on zoology, and he wrote on animals. He wrote on drama, how to put on a play. Aristotle touched on everything, how to give a speech. He wrote all sorts of manuals on everything. But if you look at the parts of Aristotle that so intrigued, let's say, the Rambam, it really was the part of Aristotle dealing with metaphysics. What is reality? What is the structure of matter? How do you get the many from the one? Right? And that's why we developed the idea of there's matter and there's form and all these different things. So, but if you look at, for example, Aristotle's book on politics, which was a very, very highly regarded book, it almost didn't interest. I mean, the Jewish philosophers were almost not interested in any issue of political theory. The one exception to this, the one major exception, is the Abarbanel. The Abarbanel does have a very, very interesting essay on the ideal Jewish state from a political theory. And he discusses this and I think it's unique. He discusses this in the context of the famous biblical question that when the Jewish people asked Samuel for a king, so if you recall, he gave them a whole speech how, you're doing a sin. God, what's wrong with God ruling over you? Why do you want a king? And the big question that the commentators ask is, God says in the Torah that the Jewish people should have a king. So if they're asking for a king, they're asking to fulfill one of the divine commandments. Why is Shmuel so unhappy about it? So there are a lot of answers. The Rambam says, it depends why you're asking. Are you asking for a king to keep the Torah? We're asking for kings to be like all the nations of the world, etc. So the Rambam says it's a question of motivation. But the Abarbanel, and I guess this is one of the things the Maharal would criticize him, but the Abarbanel takes an approach which is actually the opposite of Talmud's approach. He says, no mitzvah to have a king at all. The Torah says, if you do a sin and ask for a king, you'll get one, but better not to ask for a king. Which is against the Gemara, actually. But this is the Abarbanel's position. And he has a long essay why he regards a representative republic, where you elect representatives, is the superior form of government. And keep in mind that it's very clear, the Abarbanel alludes to this, that he is writing from his own autobiographical experience. He wrote this essay after he was expelled from Spain in 1492, and from Spain he went to Italy, and Italy had a bunch of city-states, Genoa, Venice, Florence, and he was very impressed by the self-government of these city-states. He talks about the fact that the governors or the mayors, whatever they were called, were elected. He talks about the fact that there were term limits, right? He actually says that they were elected for a limited term, and therefore they would then be replaced. And he suggests that term limits are very good, because when you will be accountable to your electorate, and when you can be on the outs, right? That you make certain decisions, but in a few years you will be under somebody else's rule, you're going to be very, very careful regarding the decisions that you make, and therefore this creates accountability, this creates responsibility. So he was in favor of a society in which representatives are elected for limited terms and are accountable to the people. And then he says, unlike the monarchs of Spain, the like, who do whatever they want, and nobody is able to stand up against them. Of course, keep in mind that I assume that even the Abarbanel, understood very well that Moshiach is envisioned as being a king, but once again, that's a god, a monarch from God. But in terms of how a society should set up its government, he feels a king is the worst thing to do. And of course, this is in contradistinction to Plato, who actually was in favor of the so-called philosopher king. So this is, but I just mentioned this again, so I'm going off on a lot of different topics today, but I mention this simply because it is highly unusual. It seems that Jewish medieval philosophy, and even the Maharal, etc., was almost profoundly indifferent to issues of political organization. Part of that would be because for many Jewish communities that was not a relevant issue, simply because of the powerlessness that we had in the Gola. Although, I'm surprised that they didn't devote more time to it, because on the other hand, precisely during the medieval periods of ghettos, Jewish self-government was in fact a very powerful phenomenon. In other words, within the walls of ghettos, Jews were given much more authority than they are today. They had their own court system, which was recognized by the state, as they could imprison Jews and even execute them in some cases. So Jewish self-government within the confines of the limited sphere was actually a much more potent feat. In fact, there's a classic book by Louis Finkelstein, the professor at JTS, called Jewish Self-Government in the Middle Ages, which shows how extensive this was. There were all sorts of rules. In fact, the Maharal was very, very active in aspects of self-government. For example, in Prague, as in other cities, there were what are called anti-sumptuary laws. Anti-sumptuary laws means laws restricting what you could spend for happy occasions, bar mitzvahs, weddings, because there was a fear.
Can we bring that back?
Well, people are talking about it. There was a fear that to keep up with the Joneses or keep up with the Katzes, you know, you'd bankrupt yourself. And I actually saw an example of like Prague, in the time of the Maharal, said something like, you have your choice in one fish course and one meat course, right? You can't have both, etc. And how much jewelry is allowed to be worn in public. Part of it is also for anti-Semitic reasons, that not to create jealousy among the non-Jewish populations. And these laws were enforced. Now, of course, the problem was, legal scholars have some criticism here, because they were usually enforced by fines. Now, that means, basically, if I'm rich enough, I'll invite everybody I want and just pay more money for it, right? So, some have said, historians of law have said, that sometimes the anti-sumptuary laws were revenue-raising devices. They were not really deterrents, as it were. Okay, but be it as it may, certainly the Maharal's Kavana, and he wasn't the only one, this was many of the communities had them, was to discourage this, although the communities, the lay leadership of the communities, may have looked at it like a fundraising device. You know, so that's, because keep in mind that we don't, you know, sometimes we don't realize how powerful lay authority was in the Middle Ages. I mean, rabbis were not making all the decisions. There were very, very powerful communal boards that would make all sorts of rules on their own, which were sometimes approved by the rabbinic leadership and sometimes were not. A whole interesting and difficult chapter in terms of the allocation of rabbinic authority versus secular authority within a Jewish community, which has interesting parallels even today. How did I get onto this? I don't remember. Abarbanel. Okay, I was just digressing by saying that the Abarbanel is the last great medieval Jewish philosopher, but he was interested in politics much more. In fact, he was a politician himself much more than his predecessors. So it's very, very interesting that
The Rambam, of course, had some interest in it, but the Rambam's main interest was metaphysics. It was not political theory.
Did they not write about this topic in fear of being accused of treason?
That might be a possibility. It might be. Again, it's only speculation. It could be that certain issues were not discussed, like what is the form of an ideal Jewish society, simply because that might indicate a disloyalty to the government. Even the Abarbanel didn't write about it until he got kicked out of Spain. Then he began to write a little bit about political philosophy. Okay, so that's a little bit about the Aleph Beis here. Now, one thing, there's a chart. If you have your kuzri here, I just want to just go over this, just show you the chart again. There's not a lot that I can say about it, because it ultimately is a mystical thing. But this chart is not Rabbi Karapkin's chart. This chart actually appears in the, I'm sorry, page 236. This chart actually appears in the Kuzari itself. This is Rabbi Yehuda Halevi's chart. And it's based, just so you get the designation if you didn't get it, the alphabet, the 22 letters of the alphabet, are divided into three components. There are the three mothers, the Shalosh Imahot, and the three mother letters are Aleph, Mem, and Shin. Emesh. Now, Emesh actually is a word in Hebrew. It means yesterday. It's not really clear if there's any significance to the word. But the Sefer Yetzirah writes that the Aleph symbolizes Avir, air, wind. The Mem symbolizes Mayim, water. And the Shin symbolizes Esh, the second letter of Esh. So consequently, the Sefer Yetzirah says, this is a little different than the Greek idea, that the world was based on these four elements, because in the Greek idea there's wind, water, fire, and dirt. Although that's brought up in many, many places in Chazal as well. But the Sefer Yetzirah says that the fundamental building blocks of the universe are the wind, the fire, and the water. And the Afar emerges from various combinations of that. So they're called the mother letters because the powers and forces that they represent are that which brings the physical universe into being through the elements of air, water, and fire. Even heaven, for example, is said to be a combination. Shamayim is Esh Mayim. Fire and water combines to create the Shamayim. Now, then, we have a second level, right? So on top of the pyramid are the three Imahot. The next level, branching out, are the seven Kefelot, the seven double letters. Now here actually is an amazing thing. The double letters, now you know them as six. This is the Beged Kepet. That's Beged Kepet. These are the six letters that can come with a dagesh, with a dot, without a dot. Now, amazingly enough, the Sefer Yetzirah says there are seven letters. It adds Bet, Gimel, Dalet, that's the Beget. So far so good. Kaf, Pei, it adds Resh. That the Sefer Yetzirah, and then Tuf. The Sefer Yetzirah actually recognized two forms of Resh. A Resh with a Dagesh, a Resh without a Dagesh. And Rabbi Karapkin notes that that modern Hebrew grammar text no longer recognizes a dagesh and resh. Of course, the truth of the matter is, modern Hebrew pronunciation doesn't even recognize in the Beged Kepet itself. For example, all right, bet and vets, okay, that we know. Gimel, right? Standard Ashkenazi or Sephardic pronunciation, standard, not Yemenite, recognizes no difference in pronunciation between a gimel dagesh and a gimel without dagesh. Although in Yemenite, there would be the soft G sound, which we don't have in modern Hebrew. George, a gimel, there's a soft gimel. Dalet, also in standard Hebrew, of Ashkenazi or Sephardi pronunciation. See, we're very impoverished. I mean, there's so many things, you know, we don't, I mean, chaf and chaf, if you think about this, you know, our connection to the Hebrew language is just lousy, and I don't just mean you know, Americans. I mean Israelis.
There is a distinction between the
That's right, but
and the ayin,
yeah. Ayin and aleph, right?
Ayin and aleph, right?
Right. So the standard Hebrew speaker, the standard Hebrew speaker, Ayin is the same as Aleph. Ches is the same as Chav. There's no difference between a Dagesh and a Gimel and a Dagesh not in a Gimel. There's no difference between a Dagesh and a Dalet not. You know, and half of the Hebrew letters, you know, are all the same to us. Because, well, particularly if you come from a Western country, you know, the guttural thing, the guttural chut sound is not so easy for us anyway. But Ches comes from the palate. Ches. In fact, when you pronounce the letters, you see the difference. Not in the words. You pronounce Ches, the sound you're making is with the palate. Chaf comes from the throat. So Chaf is a throaty letter. It's from the Garon. And Ches is a palate letter. So by pronouncing the letters, actually, you can see that. But in pronouncing a word, we basically don't distinguish. So we're very impoverished with Hebrew. Tunisia, Sephardim, yeah.
No, I'm not Sephardim.
Okay, but Yemenites have distinct pronunciations. Dalit, they have with the Dalit, they have a TH sound. So, Zha and Tha, which are not present in the way we pronounce Hebrew, come across
that. That is Sephardic pronunciation. That is traditional Sephardic pronunciation.
Yeah,
if you call Sephardic just contemporary Hebrew, right. Not Israeli Hebrew, that's not Sephardic pronunciation.
Right.
All Sephardic pronunciation uses that.
Right, that's what I meant. That's why I said modern, yeah.
Spanish, Sephardic,
right.
Greek,
right.
Turkish, Italian,
right.
Spanish.
Yeah, in fact, the even calling, let's say, we call spoken Israeli Hebrew, we call it Sephardic, that's what it's called.
Right.
It's not really Sephardic.
Right.
It's only Sephardic, basically because you just, you have a, you know, a hard tuff instead of a suck, you know, basically in a pata. But even then, look at the problem. Let's take Israeli pronunciation. What is the difference between a kamatz and a patach? Right? Kamatz is an aw sound.
Mm-hmm.
So Ashkenazim emphasize an aw versus an ah.
Mm-hmm.
Right? But in modern Sephardic, modern Israeli pronunciation, you're obliterating that. Obviously, it's supposed to be a different sound. What is a kamatz katan and a kamatz gadol? What on earth is the difference there? We have all sorts of rules in grammar books. When do you use a kamatz katan and a kamatz gadol? What sense does that make, since we pronounce them the same? You know, so we've lost.
We don't teach it that way.
How do you teach it?
We teach that there is a difference of sound dependent on.
So. Yeah, but how do you pronounce the difference? How do you pronounce it differently? Well, but in Israel, but in modern, let's say modern spoken Israeli Hebrew.
Except in Kol, the
right?
Only word that they
no,
make
it,
no,
well, so maybe some teachers are coming back to trying to recapture authentic pronunciations, but it is a big problem. So it doesn't bother me so much if Rav Yehuda Halevi quotes Sefer Yetzirah that recognized a resh with a dagesh and without, and how do we pronounce that since there's so much other things. But nevertheless, fascinatingly enough, a category of Sheva Kefulot, the letters, these are not final letters, the letters that appear with dagesh and not dagesh, is 7. So we have 3 and 7. And then we have the 12, that's 22, Peshutot, are really all the other letters that don't have anything special. Because they don't have a dagesh form or a non-dagesh form, at least in terms of pronunciation. They may have a dagesh, but not for in terms of how you pronounce the actual sound. Now, what the Sefer Yetzirah then does is the following. The Sefer Yetzirah creates a basic three-step way of describing totality of existence. This is a famous three-step category called Olam, world, Shana, year, nefesh, soul.
Mm-hmm.
Olam essentially corresponds with place, Shana corresponds with time, and nefesh corresponds with life force. Meaning, I live, I exist within the confines of Olam, space, and Shana, time. Right? So this idea of Olam, Shana, nefesh, recognizes the fact that when God creates a physical world, even with a soul that is a spiritual entity, the existence of that soul in this world is bounded by the constraints of time and place. Olam Shana Nefesh. What it then does is, if you look at the charts, and again, I don't have any particular insight in this chart. I just want to point out the chart for your own contemplation. That's why it says, let's look at the three mothers, for example. Olam, Shana, right? Universe is Olam, soul is Nefesh, and year is Shana. And then you line up, let's say, the three mothers. So in terms of universe, what they create in my environment of space, the Aleph stands for Avir, that gives rise to air. The Mem stands for Mayim, that gives rise to water. The Shin stands for Esh. So what they contribute to my space is air, water, fire. What they contribute to my being, soul does not mean soul so much, but it means my physical being. So here it connects it to organs of the body, chest, stomach, head. And what it contributes to the year, to the season. So we're told temperance, that basically means moderate climate, when things are in balance. Water contributes cold. Shin contributes heat. Again, this is a chart, or this is a kind of hierarchy or a taxonomy in which the letters, the kochot, the powers of those letters, give rise to phenomenon that manifest themselves on these three levels of Olam, Shana, Nefesh. Now, if you go to the next chart, the seven doubles, so here he has Bet, Gimel, Dalet, Kaf, Pei, Reish, right, that's the one that is unusual, and Tuf. So here, in terms of the universe, that's the Olam, these letters are correlated to what are called the Shirah Lechet. That literally means the seven moving stars, but that was the term for the planets. And of course we have more planets that we've discovered today, but based on the Sefer Yetzirah, we look at these different planets, and these different letters and planets give rise to capacities of soul, wisdom, wealth, rulership, life, grace, progeny, peace, and then the year. The year are the 7 days of the week. So you see that the seven doubles are connected to the 7 days of the week. Shabbat is connected to Bet. Now, I don't have any explanation for the other ones, but I'll just say the reason Shabbat is connected to Bet is based on the idea that every day of the week has its partner. Sunday has a partnership with Monday. Tuesday has a partnership with Wednesday. Thursday has a partnership with Friday. Shabbat is all alone, but the Jewish people are the companion of Shabbat. Therefore, Shabbat is connected to Bet, because Bet is two, unification, connection. We are connected to Shabbat. God is connected to Shabbat, etc. So the concept, therefore, is that Olam Shana Nefesh. There is a letter. There is a planet. There is a capacity of the soul. There is a day of the week. You will also notice, therefore, that Shabbat in the year is connected to wisdom in the soul. Thursday in the year is connected to wealth. So if you buy a lottery ticket, perhaps do it on Thursday. Tuesday, these days don't even go in order, is connected to rulership. Sunday is connected to life. Friday is connected to grace. Wednesday connected to progeny. Again, this is in the Sefer Yetzirah. Again, this is Kabbalistic, and I don't have... Huh? That's correct. So obviously there are meanings that we don't understand. I am not attempting to explain this. I just want you to see what the organizational principle is. The organizational principle is that you take the letters of the Aleph Beis, you line them up of three dimensions of reality. Olam, universe, which is space. Shana, time of year, time. And Nefesh, quality of soul. And then we say each particular letter gives rise to a spiritual manifestation in space, in time, and in the moral faculty within myself. Yeah.
But I find myself asking with this chart, and particularly with the one that's coming up,
right,
where's God in all of this?
Mm-hmm. That's a good question, but basically what Sefer Yetzirah is concerned with describing is it's a book of anatomy, as it were. It is trying to describe the physical mechanisms not the physical, the spiritual mechanisms by which God creates and runs the world. Meaning, God runs the world, as it were. But God runs the world through the mechanisms that he has created.
I'm very surprised to see astrology,
right. Yeah.
Astrological signs.
Right.
Astronomical
right.
signs
have,
makes a little more sense.
Yeah, you see what's going on here, because the three mothers are the three elements, the seven doubles are the seven planets, and the 12 regulars are the signs of the zodiac. So you're correct. Certainly the third chart explicitly uses some type of notion of astrology. Now, this itself, we have to know there's a lot of controversy here. One has to say that, obviously, Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi is quoting this as an example of great wisdom. He apparently is subscribing to the notion that the Kochavim, granted, coming from God, have certain, not autonomous powers, but they have certain influences they produce on the world. It's important to call to your attention that the Rambam, Maimonides, was essentially, although it's a little strange, the Rambam's position is not as clear as one would assume. The Rambam at various places says this is junk, this is stupid, this is absolutely not true. Although, at the same time, in other parts of his writings, he occasionally does acknowledge the influence of Kochavim. That would seem to suggest that the traditional Jewish response to all of this was not to disparage that there is such a thing as astrology, but rather to disparage the actual practitioners of what they were doing as false. There is kind of true astrology and false astrology, and a lot of present astrology was false, but that did not disparage it as a principle. But as I say, the Rambam is not clear, because there are places where the Rambam implies that he totally rejects the notion of Kochavim. Now, just to go back to Talmudic sources here, again, I don't have the skill to take you through this detail by detail. I just want you to be aware of the chart and what's going on. But the Talmud itself does clearly indicate at various points that events that happen in a human being's life are to some degree affected by astrological constellations of stars. There's a statement in the Talmud that says, this is in Aramaic, Bani Chaye Umizone. Bani or Banim. Children, life, and mizone, and food, sustenance. Lo bischusa tal yamilsa. Does not depend only on merit. Ela b'mazla tal yamilsa. It depends on mazal. Even the phrase mazal tov. Mazal tov means, may you have a good constellation. That's what it means. And the whole thing is referring to the constellations of the stars. So, on one hand, there was a belief that Chazal talked about in terms of mazalot. Mazalot are constellations. On the other hand, there's a statement in Chazal that says, Ein mazal li Yisrael. There is no mazal, there is no constellation that governs the Jewish people. The Jewish people are governed directly by their relationship to God. On the other hand, there are many interpretations of what Ein Mazal Yisrael means. Because how do you reconcile Ein Mazal Yisrael with a statement that a person's life and children depend on mazalot? And many therefore learn there is mazal, but through prayer and tshuva, one can transcend it. Meaning, mazal is what you would call a default principle that operates in the universe, which I may transcend, but until I transcend it, I am subject to its limitations. Right? Depends how you understand that. Nachmanides writes that in Chutz La'aretz, outside of the land of Israel, God runs the world through mazalot, although through prayer one could transcend it. It's only in the land of Israel that one is directly under God's providence without the intermediation of mazalot. So, yeah. Yeah. Which one? Oh, the word zol. Well, it does have two common letters. As far as I know, they're not related etymologically, but zol is cheap. So, according to this, there is indeed a principle of mazalot in the world as God's intermediary forces, but a Jew can transcend it, and it's inapplicable in the land of Israel. In fact, Nachmanides interprets a passage in the Talmud this way, a very beautiful passage. It says, anyone who lives in Israel, it is as if they have a God. And he who does not live in Israel, it is as if they do not have a God. So what does that mean? I don't live in Israel, I don't have a God? It says, well, you have a God, but you're under the mazalot unless you break through the mazalot and connect yourself to God. And that's a certain effort. In Israel, you're directly under God. Now, keep in mind, though, that there's a good, that there's a cost to that. Because like this, mazalot is kind of a predetermined thing that'll happen to me. And if my mazal is good, so I might get good stuff, even if I'm undeserving. In Israel, you only get what you deserve. So the concept is, God is directly involved with you, so there's no automatic pilot that runs in Israel. In Israel, everything, you know, you get what you deserve.
There's no mazal.
There's no mazal in Israel, right. There's no mazal. You're all by yourself. An idea, way. This was actually used as an anti-Aliyah idea by some great rabbis in the 19th century, where they basically said that if you're not a righteous person, maybe you don't belong in the land of Israel because you're in the palace of the king. How dare you go to the palace of the king and do improper things? If you're going to do Aveirot, stay in Chutz Laaretz. Don't come to Israel. And so that was an argument occasionally that was advanced. Say again?
They should teach
it
to the politicians.
Well, okay, you know, certainly, you know, there's enough tshuva that we all have to do for all of these things. So the issue of mazal is a complicated issue. There are those that say there's no such thing. There are those that say there is such a thing, but a Jew can transcend it. There are those that say there is such a thing in Chutz La'aretz, but not in Eretz Yisrael. And then, of course, we have to differentiate between true astrology and false astrology, meaning to say the fact that much astrological doctrine is false and idolatrous doesn't automatically say there is not something true that might be lost. Let me just mention one final Gemara. The Gemara mentions that the star or planet that you're born under might also have an impact on your personality. So for example, if you're born under Ma'adim, Ma'adim is Mars, and Ma'adim means the red planet, right? And you'll notice that it's connected to the letter Dalet, and it's connected to rulership, because after all, David, it says King David was born under the mazal of Ma'adim. And there is a statement in the Gemara Masechet Shabbat that says, he who is born under mazal Ma'adim will be a shedder of blood. He will be a one who loves to shed blood. But he has the choice. Will he be a murderer or will he be a shochet, a slaughterer? Now, this is something that's actually very important because you can look at that Gemara in two ways. Your first reaction might be, oh, astrology, planets, you know, all that stuff is nothing. I mean, let's assume that's your orientation. However, there is a deeper point in that Gemara that goes beyond the technical debates. Is there astrology or is there not? Because after all, today, let's say we don't believe in astrology, but as I say, there are different interpretations. The one thing we do believe is we believe in genetics. So the point is this. Whether we talk about a predetermined hard wiring within a person is a function of his mazal, or whether we talk about it as the DNA that is encoded in his genes, the Talmud is raising a fundamental point, a point that is of very great philosophical importance even today. The principle of mapping and sequencing the human genome, in which we'll have a complete picture of the chromosomes and the genes that are located in the 22 chromosome pairs of the human body. And we're going to see more and more aspects of our humanity is reflected in the four arrangements of the amino acids that make up a DNA molecule. Right? Not just illness. We're going to find, presumably, genetic markers for propensities for violence, homosexuality, anger, different things that we might find. And of course, rest assured that the criminal defense bar is examining these things very, very carefully to come up with genetically based defenses for criminal behaviors. We've tried that on a small level, the Twinkie defense. You know, people who get, you know, they just get crazy when they have sugar. It's called premenstrual syndrome defense, which has been invoked sometimes, you know, in terms of spouse, you know, hitting her husband with a frying pan, premenstrual defense, right? But with the advance of human genetic sequencing, there'll be many, many irregularities that we could find. And the philosophical question that this raises is, if I have a propensity to anger based on a particular gene located on my 15th chromosome, and you don't, then why should I be condemned for the behavior I exhibit if, you know, my genes made me do it? Right? What Wilson used to say, the devil made me do it. Now we can say, my genes made me do it. Well, yeah. Well, okay. Well, a mutation, right. Whatever it is, it's not my fault, right? There's always someone to blame, right? I blame my parents for giving me my genetic endowment. So the key to how to deal with this is the Talmud statement. If I'm born under the planet Mars, indeed I will have a propensity to shed blood. But what can I do? The answer the Talmud gives is that you can't necessarily change your temperament. Your temperament is what you are, but you can always choose to direct that temperament into a good and constructive channel. Or you can choose to utilize it for something destructive. In other words, you can't take a Mars person and make him abhor bloodshed, but you can direct him to use it in a positive way. Now, as I say, that's a point that goes well beyond the issue of astrology. Let's say we don't believe in astrology. Let's assume when we interpret that non-literally, and let's assume the Chachamim were talking to ignorance and prejudice of the common man, whatever you want to say. So today, we'll just substitute DNA for the planet. It's the identical problem. You're hardwired in a certain way. There's an aspect of your personality to be determined. There's a certain determinism. In spite of free will, there's a certain determinism that is built into human existence. But the free will can coexist within the limits of that determinism. Now that also means, perhaps a bit pessimistically so, that there may not be unlimited free will in life, because after all, we are bounded by our limitations. But within those limitations, again, I'm not talking about someone that does not have mental functioning at all, but within those limitations, there is the play for human autonomy and free will. And I should also say that given the fact of Ein Mazal Yisrael, I think the theological implication of that is that through prayer and Shiva, there might even be the ability to go beyond genetic endowment. But that's a higher level. But even within the genetic limitation, there is the capacity of free will in terms of directing it towards higher places. So, therefore, the issue of astrology, do Jews believe in astrology, is a quite complicated issue. It is a complicated issue. We cannot give a definitive answer. On the other hand, it is perhaps a less important issue, because if astrology is taken in a broader sense, not to refer so much to stars, but to refer to a certain element of predetermination in human existence, the answer is yes. There are aspects of ourselves that are predetermined, but that is not a negation of moral freedom and autonomy. And I think that would be the important idea to walk away with, whether we're dealing with astrology or DNA. And once again, I would have to say that on one hand, for, you know, the last 100 years, people can laugh at astrology, but in this century, we discovered DNA. What is DNA other than, you know, the stars that you're born with inside of you, you know? So, in a sense, it almost revalidates the notion of this predetermination, although it uses a different factor in creating it.
There's actually a passage in the Talmud where it mentions a particular Amora, where the mother found out that under the stars that the son will be a tremendous thief.
Right.
And rabbis consulted her and told her that she should have his head always covered. Mm-hmm. That way he'll be Yoram Malka, you will not fear of heaven, he'll never steal.
Right, right.
The Gemara goes on to say that one day his yarmulke flew off, and before he knew it, he was up the tree
stealing. For the tree, right, for the apple. Right. That's right. That's the source, by the way, of wearing a kippah. Exactly that Talmud, that Rav Nachman's mother, when Nachman was a small child, she kept his head covered all the time so he should be aware of godliness, of God. And as soon as that fell off, as he said, he was already prone to that. Right? So, since none of us knows, whether we're prone to that, so we try to, you know, at least the men, I guess the women are more naturally honest or something, but the men try to get it.
But the strange thing about that Gemara is that it seems that there was nothing wrong with this woman finding out that the son was born under a certain star, and therefore he had this deterministic factor, that there's nothing wrong with finding out a person's predetermined nature.
Again, there's some technical issues. Are you allowed to go to astrologers and the like? But in terms of finding out propensities, that would be analogous to getting a genetic test, right? And that's what you're doing community now.
Well, you can see if you have talent, and then you can use it.
Right.
Either you'll become a musician, or you won't be a musician.
Right. So
you
it's
work on that skill.
Right. So it's okay to try to find out what propensities you have. You know, that issue of testing. Strange building today. Okay. Yeah. Maybe I shouldn't be talking with so much mysticism. Yeah.
I'm a little confused by when they talk about the soul. They talk about organs of, what's an organ of laughter?
No, yeah, the translation isn't so great here. No, it just means it really refers to faculties. The faculty of sight, the faculty of smell. In fact, this confuses me a little bit. I am fundamentally ignorant about much of this, but I know the passages of Sefer Yetzirah that I know actually do not correspond with what I see in this chart. Let me give you an example. Again, if you look at the third chart, you got the 12 signs of the zodiac, and they are aligned with months. You see, it's a double column, so it's a little more confusing. But Aries, which is a ram, is connected to the month of Nisan, because the Karban Pesach was a ram. Taurus, the bull, is connected to Iyar. Gemini, the twins, are connected to Sivan, etc. Cancer, the crab. Leo, the lion, is connected to Av. Virgo, connected to Elul. Right? You see all that? That's how you read it. That the six in the first column go to the six first months. Adar, which we're in, is connected to Pisces, the fish. That's why you'll sometimes see in Jewish calligraphy, you will see fish for the month of Adar. Because the mazal of Adar, right, is dagim, is fish, a sign of fertility and blessing, and the like. In fact, it's very interesting. Okay,
you know that people before,
synagogue mosaic, the 12 signs of the zodiac. Now, I will say that this connection of months to the signs of the zodiac is something that recurs over and over again in Hasidic literature. There are whole books that are written connecting the signs of the zodiac to particular months. The Bnei Yisachar, one of the classic Hasidic books, is really entirely devoted to this. Rav Tzedek of Lublin writes extensively on it. But here is one thing. The 2 months that I'm familiar with, if you look at the month of Cheshvan, where's Cheshvan? Mar Cheshvan, yeah. So Mar Cheshvan, according to this chart, is connected to Scorpio, but in terms of the capacity, the sense, is connected to the sense of hearing. Mm-hmm. And what letter is it? Do we have the letters here? I'm sorry. Organ of moving. Movements.
Also hearing.
Movements.
Also hearing.
No, hearing is ER. Hearing is ER. Do you see how I read this? Yeah, I don't know why he didn't make it a bigger chart and make 12, but no. Cheshvan is organ of moving, not organ of hearing. And does he tell you which letters? He doesn't even tell you which letters here.
The first six are on the top and the last six.
Yes, but which letter of the 12 regulars is it connected to?
Hey, Bob, Zion, Tet, Tet. He hasn't
been on. Oh. So according to this, Cheshvan is the eighth one. So that's Hey, Bob, Zion, Tet, Tet, Yud, Lam, yeah, no, okay. That's correct. Now, so according to this, if you take the month of Cheshvan, it is connected to the letter Nun. And it's connected to the organ of movement. Actually, the Sefer Yetzirah passage that I'm familiar with is, it connects Cheshvan to the sense of smell, and there's a message for that. In other words, the text that we have is, Cheshvan is connected to the letter Nun, and it's connected to the letter Reyach. Now, which is not what it says here, but let me give you the explanation Rav Tzadok gives for that connection, and then you'll see what's going on here. We know, of course, the month of Tishrei has the most holidays of the Jewish year, and anyone that starts school in September either knows how difficult Tishrei is. But not only does it have the most holidays, but it really calls upon us to have almost opposite moods. The somberness and seriousness of Yom Kippur, although it's a very happy day, and then the joy of Sukkot, and then the unrestrained levity of Simchat Torah. It's like we pack it in. We pack in those great formative experiences at the very beginning of the year, and all of a sudden we're dropped into total emptiness. In Cheshvan, there is no holiday at all. One of the reasons why the month of Cheshvan is called Mar Cheshvan, the bitter Cheshvan, is because no Yamim Tovim. Of course, the other interpretation, Mar just means raindrops, because Cheshvan is the beginning of the rainy season in the land of Israel. But many say Cheshvan is the only holiday, the only month of the Jewish year that has no significant special day. Because every other month does. Kislev has Hanukkah, Tevet has the end of Hanukkah, Shvat has Tu B'Shvat, so it doesn't have to be a full-fledged holiday. Adar has Purim, Nisan has Pesach, Iyar has Lag BaOmer, Sivan has Shavuot, Tammuz at least has a fast day. That's also considered to be a special day. Av has the ninth of Av, which Moshiach will be born, etc. Elul, interesting, what is Elul? Elul does not have a particular holiday, although it is said that Erev Rosh Hashanah is considered to be a holiday as well. Close enough. And we blow shofar at least. Cheshvan has no ritual associated with it. Now, part of the lesson is, though, there's a very deep lesson here, because the proof that we have grown from the special days of connecting to God is whether we take those holidays and apply them in our regular life. Meaning, it's easy to serve God when emotions are high and you have peak experiences. But the real test of a Yom Tov is not how you serve God in the holiday itself, but whether you could take those lessons and take them to the everyday. Cheshvan is the proving grounds for the lessons of Tishrei. Was your tshuva sincere on Yom Kippur? Let's see what life is in the Cheshvans of the world. Did you truly get joy in your Judaism during Sukkot? How is it manifest in Cheshvan? Did you use the Sukkah and the Lulav and the Etrog for unity among Jews? Let's see how it works when things get back to normal. It's very important to have this normalcy period after the holidays to show us that we've really grown and can apply those lessons to life. Right? So Cheshvan is really a very important month in this sense. Now, the thing is this. The reason why the letter of the alphabet that is correlated to Cheshvan is the letter Nun is because Nun is connected to the word for falling, Nefila. How do we see this? Consider Ashrei. You know the Ashrei that you say? Ashrei begins with every letter of the alphabet except the letter Nun. Because Nun is Nefila. We don't want to begin a Pasuk with Nefila. God brings Nefila in the next verse. Someich Hashem l'chol, thank you. Someich Hashem l'chol nofim. God supports. Okay. God supports all those who fall. Nefila is mentioned only in the context of smicha, supports. So Nun by itself is Nefila. Cheshvan, of all the months, is a real downer. It's the month in which we seem to fall because we no longer have the holiness of the Chagim to sustain us. And that's why Cheshvan is connected to Nun. It's a time of spiritual falling. But how do you preserve Nefila? Again, the spelling isn't quite right, but you know, maybe Vav and Vet might be interchangeable in that sense. Yeah, I tell you what, maybe that's why we don't pronounce Hebrew correctly. We have unlimited, we have extra puns and word relationships we can make if you don't pronounce it correctly. Now, the thing is this. How do you prevent the Nefila from destroying you? With the capacity of smell. Because what is smell? Smell or aroma is what remains in a room when the actual substance has been removed. If you have a roast chicken, and you take the chicken out of the room, the chicken isn't here anymore. The aroma lingers. So Cheshvan teaches us, even when the Chagim have passed, we still have a Reach in the air. And therefore we open ourselves up. So that's kind of the idea. Now again, I have to confess, I'm a little surprised that apparently Rav Yehuda HaLevi had a different text for Cheshvan, because he connects Cheshvan to the organ of moving. I could also explain that, perhaps. Moving is the concept that you got to move on the peak and go into regular life. But the text that Rav Tzadok quotes, is that Cheshvan is connected to Reyach. So it's Nun and Reyach. Let me give you another example of a correlation. Again, I only know two of these correlations, but I have spoken on it. Take the month of Shavat. Let's take Shavat. Shavat is, which one is it? Shavat is Aquarius, and it's connected to laughter. Well, here again I have a problem, because the text that I have is, Shavat is connected to tasting. I reverse it. Shavat is connected to eating. What is the concept? Why is Shavat connected? Yes, that's right. The notion of eating. And the concept here is that we know that Shvat, the great day of Shvat, the only special day of Shvat, is the 15th of Shvat, that is Tu B'Shvat. And of course, many of you are familiar with the Tu B'Shvat Seder. And of course, today, for many people who keep the Tu B'Shvat Seder, it is essentially a celebration of Jewish environmentalism. But if you go back to its Kabbalistic roots, the Tu B'Shvat Seder was started by the disciples of the Ari. So it had a much more of a mystical idea. It was said to be a...